You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of June 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
It is horrific in every sense of the meaning of that word. And I think an act that obviously is profoundly filled with hate as well as a desire to sow terror in people.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry reacting to Saturday night's massacre in Orlando. My guests John Everard and Tom Rivers will be joining me for a special program dedicated to the worst mass shooting in U.S. history, the worst terrorist incident on U.S. soil since September 11th, and the worst attack specifically targeting gay people anywhere in the world in modern times. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Tom Rivers, the London correspondent for ABC Radio News, and John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, among other postings. Welcome both. Now, of the many great difficulties of knowing what to say about what happened at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando this weekend, chief among them is that it is really only the scale of the massacre, 49 dead, 53 wounded, the worst spree killing in US history, that makes it remarkable. The fundamentals of the story are by now wearisomely familiar. Dismal young man, riven with misogynist and or racist and or homophobic resentments, legally acquires the means to act upon his hatreds and opens fire on wholly blameless people. We'll be discussing the implications in full shortly, but first I will go to Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis, who is in Orlando. Thomas, what is the latest in Orlando? What are the local authorities saying now?
Well, we are waiting for another statement to the press, Andrew, here in Orlando. I'm just on South Orange Avenue, which is where the majority of the national and the world media have gathered. It's not far from the Pulse nightclub, which is still, as you'd expect, ringed off by a big cordon of police cars as those investigations are ongoing. Now, the list of the names of the victims, more victims' names were released today. 10 names were released on Sunday, an additional 4 today. And the local press here are publishing very poignant stories and little snapshots, I suppose, from the lives of those who were taken, many of whom were in their early to mid-20s, some of whom were visiting on holiday, many of whom were residents of Orlando too. So we are expecting that grim roll call to continue to be extended later today, and the stories of those who were in the Pulse nightclub on Saturday night will continue to emerge too.
Thomas, there are reports of commemorations and vigils being planned by way of response all over the world. There's one here in London a little under an hour from now in Old Compton Street, in fact. Is there anything of that sort being planned for Orlando, or have people not quite got their heads to that stage yet?
Yes, well, I went to one of those vigils last night, Andrew, just after I arrived at the Parliament House motel and dance venue, which is quite a storied LGBT venue here in Orlando. And at the time of that vigil at 7 p.m, it was absolutely packed by all accounts from the people I spoke to there. Now, the police had issued a plea, if you like, to the people of Orlando not to hold too many outdoor vigils, given that they said that their manpower is so stretched, understandably, at the moment. Now, I have heard a report of a vigil planned near the lake here in the centre of the city at around 6 p.m. I'd say at the event last night, it was really quite a strange atmosphere, as you'd expect. There was a somber mood, but also a celebratory one too. It was in venues like the Pulse nightclub, like the Parliament House motel and dance venue, that members of the LGBT community both felt safe and also came to sort of, you know, celebrate their identities and celebrate who they were and where they were too. And I think a lot of the people I spoke to last night were pretty determined not to let that be dismantled by the horrifying events of Saturday night at Pulse.
Thomas Lewis, thank you. We will have more from you on The Daily later tonight. Tom and John here in the studio, I want to start with what I fear is a rhetorical question, which is there the remotest danger that this is the horror bad enough that America actually now has a serious conversation about the wisdom of permitting almost anybody to buy weapons most countries only issue to soldiers? Tom, first of all.
Well, we thought Sandy Hook maybe that. It wasn't that. San Bernardino, no. Charleston, no.
To say nothing of all the presidents that have been shot en route as well.
Well, exactly. And this is not the last chapter. This is the 18th incident on the president's watch that he's had to go to the cameras, go to the microphones, and discuss. And Lord knows it's going to be probably number 19 or 20 before he leaves the White House. Nothing is going to change at this stage of the game unless Congress changes. And that is, as he said, the decision not to take a decision is, in fact, a decision.
John, as of right now, just looking at their Twitter feed, the National Rifle Association is yet to issue any kind of statement whatsoever. Has this particular event, or the dynamics of this particular event, kind of confused them, I guess, by forcing them to decide whether they dislike Muslims or gay people most?
Yes, I'm sure it's confused them. It's the kind of, for the NRA, this is a pretty bad nightmare, and they must be very concerned that it's going to turn a large swathe of public opinion against their positions. But can I come back to the question you started this conversation with? Is this going to change anything? I think the chances that it is going to fundamentally change gun law in the United States are, frankly, not good. I think the chances that it might at least lead to the reintroduction on the ban of open sale of assault rifles might have a chance. Remember, we got that for a while before the legislation lapsed. Hillary Clinton has already come out very strongly saying that if ever proof was needed that legislation should be made permanent, this was it. So if she gets into the White House, I think there's a reasonable chance that madness at least can be stopped.
Tom, the New York Daily News front page, which you may have seen, ran with the headline, "Thanks NRA." Mm-hmm. Now, granted that the New York Daily News beat is not probably the NRA's heartland, but is there the possibility of any kind of backlash, do you think, against the NRA? I mean, it seems an obvious question, but the AR-15 is, as Hillary Clinton said herself today, it's a weapon of war. There is literally no other reason why you would want to own one.
And it has been used in the past. It is designed to kill human beings. The big question is, can anything change? And you look at what Donald Trump was tweeting today.
If we must.
And also we interviewed him, NBC interviewed Hillary, and he says no, just the opposite. And again, you look at gun sales. After every single episode, gun sales the next week have gone up.
Smith & Wesson stock up 8% today.
7.5%, Ruger up 9%. I think that's the real message. People are internalizing this and getting a stockpile because they feel that is a way to protect themselves, although guns used in self-defense are a fraction of involved in a fraction of the incidents that actually happen when there's exchange of gunfire.
Well, as we have brought Donald Trump's name into this, we should take a look at the political consequences of Orlando. Now, to some extent, it is going to be, and indeed already is, the same pointless row traditionally conducted in these circumstances. That's where one side suggests that maybe the risks of allowing the unhinged and malevolent to purchase automatic weapons outweigh the benefits. And the other retorts that the mildest obstruction of an American's right to bear arms will result in the hammer and sickle flying over the Capitol by this time next week. We will look at what the current contenders for the White House said shortly. Here's what President Barack Obama said earlier.
My concern is that we start getting into a debate, as has happened in the past, which is an either-or debate. And the suggestion is either we think about something as terrorism and we ignore the problems with easy access to firearms, or it's all about firearms and we ignore the role, the very real role that organizations like ISIL have in generating extremist views inside this country. And it's not an either or, it's a both and. We have to go after these terrorist organizations and hit them hard. We have to counter extremism. But we also have to make sure that it is not easy for somebody who decides they want to harm people in this country to be able to obtain weapons to get at them.
John, Donald Trump has reacted to this with, I guess, what we could call characteristic oafishness. He's basically said, "I told you so." Is there any reason to believe that taking that stance, which I'm sure is no more or less than we would expect at this point, is going to cost him any votes?
It will cost him votes in the centre of politics, but the centre of politics is not where he wants to be in any case. So the answer to your question is yes, but it probably doesn't worry him that much, frankly. Can I, just with a hanging end from the previous bit, we were talking about changes to the legislation on firearms. Absolutely. But there are big questions over also over implementation of what is already on the statute book. The ATF guidelines make very clear that you should never sell a firearm to somebody who is mentally unstable. You should never sell a firearm to somebody against whom there is a court order for domestic violence. And we know from Martin's ex-wife that he was unstable. It's just the system never generated the bit of paper that was required so that gunshots would refuse to serve him. And that she had to be rescued from what sounds like an absolute nightmare of a marriage. If she had actually generated a court order at that stage, it is entirely possible that he would not have acquired the firearms with which he committed this massacre. Implementation as well as legislation.
Exactly. And he had gone through, John, as we all know, but last week, he purchased the assault weapon on one day. 2 days later, he bought the pistol. But he went through the three-day, quote-unquote, review phase, and nothing was picked up. And the fact that the FBI as well interviewed him two occasions back in 2013, that somehow was not in the loop as well. And it just shows you that if this is a fishing net, the squares are pretty big and wide, and allows an individual like this to acquire this kind of weaponry.
We'll come back to the killer himself shortly. I want to keep looking at how this is going to play, I guess, into the presidential election. As we mentioned earlier, Hillary Clinton has called for a return to common sense gun safety reform. I mean, return to, I guess, everything's relative. Is this something, though, John, I wonder, is it one of those things that counterintuitively maybe this can only be done by a Republican who has the credibility on gun ownership and on the Second Amendment? Because every time a Democrat talks about gun control, it inflames the Republican base beyond the point of any reason. Is it the kind of thing where if a Republican president was to get out in front of it, I realize I'm indulging in wild hypothetical fantasy here, that might make it more likely?
Short answer, no. I don't think it's true that only a Republican president could push this through. You're quite right that the NRA, the gun lobby in general in the United States, tend to abreact to Democrats. But that doesn't mean that a Democratic president with a certain amount of willpower couldn't force this through, particularly in the wake of what's happened. Secondly, even if it were true that only a Republican president could push this through, I really can't see any Republican president squaring up to his political base and saying he was going to do it. That would be utter political suicide in the United States. So, no.
Tom, how wrong-footed is, I guess, especially Republicans going to be by the nature of the targeted victims in this case? This was clearly, among other things, a specifically homophobic hate crime. It was targeted at a gay nightclub. It was, by and I can't think of an exception to it, the worst single targeted attack upon gay people anywhere in the world since at least the Second World War. Now, if an attack of this scale, of course, happened at, as they often have, at a school or at a workplace or a cinema or a shopping mall, then there's an established template for any presidential candidate. You turn up, you look concerned, you speak to victims and so on and so on and so on. Have the Republican Party painted themselves into the kind of corner where they actually have to think about how that's going to look to their base in this particular instance?
Well, I think, Andrew, things have changed in America over the past decade, maybe less than that. But I think that, given the scale of this and the graphicness of this particular attack, they have to show up. They have to say, this, because it's a nightclub for gays. If it's a church, it is a school, it is a cinema. They have to show up, and they have to say the right words, and they really have to. There's no going back on that.
On the subject of saying the right words, John, there's been some criticism of President Obama, not least from Donald Trump, who actually today has gone rather beyond that and made, well, I don't know if dog whistle's even the word. It's basically been the blaring trombone, suggesting that Obama is in some respect complicit. Trump's exact words were, he doesn't get it or he gets it better than anybody understands. It's one or the other. Leaving aside that sort of nonsense, is it possible that Obama has been perhaps too punctilious in avoiding describing Islamist terrorism as Islamist terrorism?
No, I think he's got the wording exactly right. I believe that I mean, these remarks were carefully crafted, and he was taking great care not to give Islamic State the glory, as it would be in Islamic State eyes, of this attack. There is no real evidence, so far at least, linking Mateen to Islamic State directly, other than that he appears to have consumed sickening amounts of Islamic State material, videos, and so on. So self-radicalized. Mm-hmm. Islamic State have leapt forward and tried to claim this atrocity as one of their own. And I think President Obama was being very careful not to feed that fire. And I think he was right.
Okay, well, on that note, we should look now at what we do know about the killer. And on the available evidence, it does seem unlikely that the world would have known the name of Omar Mateen in any other context. As is invariably the case when the lives of America's mass murderers are ransacked by the media in the days following their crimes, the picture that emerges is not attractive. Mateen, 29, gives every appearance of having been both thoroughly unpleasant and somewhat delusional. He was violent towards his ex-wife and falsely claimed association with the Sarnaev brothers, the Boston Marathon bombers. Tom, there's going to be an awful lot, and you know, inevitably and probably correctly, research and speculation about his motive. But when you're looking at a crime of this scale of both horror and lunacy, does the motive even matter, really?
I think it's important. It really is. And they're going to be going through every final computer file to determine this, if you will, balance. Is it hate? Is it radical Islamism? Is it a mixture of the two? But they're going to be looking at that. And as John points out, if you are self-radicalized, you don't have to go off to a training camp in Syria. You can click on the internet, and that can rewire yourself. And if you are of such a bent, can send you off on something like this.
Well, John, as you pointed out, Islamic State have claimed the attack. The latest word from American authorities that there is no clear evidence that he was actually part of any plot. He was, as Tom was saying, a self-starter, if you will. Is there anything, and this is, again, it's the great difficulty that I'm sure US authorities run up against, in a population of that size with so many guns in circulation, are there any actual steps that you can take to stop people self-radicalizing, as it were?
Almost none. It's a really, really tough nut to crack. And it particularly as Islamic State employ a small army, in fact, not a small, but quite a large army of keyboard bashers, looking for the weak links in American society, looking for people who are likely to be vulnerable to self-radicalization and feeding that all the time. It is one of the areas in which it is very, very difficult for the US authorities to respond adequately to Islamic State. Attempts to police social media, as we know from various efforts last year, valiant though they are, haven't really produced many results. And even as quickly as you shut down one feed, another one pops up. You're playing, you're just bashing the frog again, aren't you? It's not going to work.
Tom, you mentioned earlier that we have already discovered that the FBI had spoken to Omar Mateen on at least a couple of occasions. They're going to be criticized inevitably for that. But is it, what strikes you as more likely, that the FBI somehow dropped the ball, or, and I have no trouble imagining this, that they get so many calls and tip-offs about fantasists and blowhards that they don't have the resources to keep up with all of it?
Well, from what we know at this stage, they interviewed him, they talked to his work colleagues, where I guess a lot of this rhetoric came out. And a determination was made at that stage that we're not going to pursue this. We're not going to use any more resources to follow this through. Just like an individual that is pretty angry, but he's not going to be doing anything. And you do not have unlimited resources to check out every single person that has a gripe about anything. So at some stage, you got to drop off the list.
And that seems to have been what they've done. Of course, that brings us back, I guess, John, to the original problem, which is that until he walked into that club and pulled the trigger, he hadn't broken the law.
No, that's right. Not only had he not broken the law, he hadn't come close to breaking the law. I mean, he had expressed radical, deeply unpleasant opinions, but that's not actually illegal. And the burden of proof for the FBI to be able to take positive action against an individual is actually quite high. There was no way that they were going to bring him in. So yes, in legal terms, he was clean. He was under surveillance periodically, it is clear. But there's actually very little that the FBI legally could have done to stop it.
The other thought that occurs to me before we move on to talking about the way this is being covered, and it's a thought that occurs to me without me really having any idea where it gets us, but is it maybe not, are we maybe barking up the wrong tree in thinking about events like this? They tend to be thought of as, in this particular instance, homophobic violence, which I'm sure it was, or Islamist violence, and I'm sure it was that as well. But the one thing that almost all such other attacks have in common is that they are committed by young men. I mean, Tom, I'll put it to you first. Is this basically more of a young men problem?
I hadn't thought of it, but it certainly looks that way, doesn't it? If you go down the list of, I guess, the most infamous attacks of late, you're absolutely right. And what do you do about that, Andrew? I'm not sure. But yes, it is individuals that are somehow out there and, for the most part, lone wolf individuals, very, very difficult to sometimes read. And they've got a gripe, and they don't let it go.
Because it's not like, it is not like he had no history of violence. He does appear to have had a fairly gruesome record for that. But again, John, I suppose the trouble is, there isn't a continuum of inevitability from attacking your wife or partner to committing mass murder. In both instances, you are a completely dreadful man, but it's hard to know where the authorities should attempt to intercept.
Yeah, well, no, the line is actually clear. It is where a court order is issued. You need the bit of paper to come out of the system to be able to intercept. As I was saying earlier, that was the key thing that didn't happen, and that is what allowed him to continue to buy firearms. There is no clear path. No, I mean, a lot of absolutely dreadful men beat their wives, which is a shocking thing to do, but do not go on to commit mass murder. The FBI had no real reason to believe that this man would.
Well, finally tonight, we should look at how the media is covering it. Now, Tom, you've covered not dissimilar events in Europe,
right,
as opposed to the United States. Do you sense a difference in the way they are both covered by the media and perceived by the public here? Do they seem weirder to Europeans because Europe does not have the same gun culture as America?
I think we used to think that way until you started getting things like the atrocity in Oslo. Or Charlie Hebdo, or the attack in November in Paris. And you learn that, yes, these things can happen here, not with the regularity that you see them in America. But it used to, be viewed as solely an American problem. And maybe things have changed now, and people see this happening as well. It might be a smaller, isolated case, say, in Germany, but it does happen here, too.
John, what have you made of the way the media has or is trying to deal with the motivations, as we understand them, of the killer? I guess where is that balance, do you think, between asking, I think, what are fair questions about whether the man's religion was a factor in what he did, but without wanting to inflame sentiment against other people who practice the same faith?
Yes, I mean, these are entirely legitimate questions. I think the problem is not that the question has been posed, but we know so little about the man at this stage, and we are unable to give answers. Can I just pick up something on something Tom said? Yes, these attacks have happened elsewhere. One of the chilling things that comes out of this attack is that it's likely that even if Mateen had not had access to firearms, he would still have committed mass murder. It seems he was carrying explosives. And, okay, he was shot before he detonated his belt or whatever he was carrying. But you can see the videos of the venue. Even a modest detonation in there would have caused enormous human damage, a lot more deaths, just as we've seen in Europe. Firearms control absolutely needs to come in, but you should not imagine that that would have stopped this massacre.
Tom, American media, unfortunately, has become very practiced at covering events like this. Whether for better or for worse, do you get the impression that since, say, I don't know, Columbine, the nature of coverage has evolved in any particular direction?
Well, it kind of goes in transom with the rise of 24/7 news as well in America. And you're filing until you drop. And then comes the moment after a long day that you sit on the curb and you look up into the sky and you search for your answers. And the answer is, there is no answer. You're trying to apply logic to the illogical. And you talk to, we've all been through it, and you talk to my colleagues that are in Orlando now. They're going to walk away from this going, I don't get it. I really do not get it. And that's the sad part of this as well.
Well, it is that thing of trying to explain the inexplicable, which is, I guess, was what we're doing ourselves here this evening. But, John, what if you, in this particular instance, the aspect of it that's made me flinch a little bit is kind of parading the killer's father on air. Now, I get the impression that, again, it might be arguable that the acorn has not fallen terrifically far from the tree in this instance, but nonetheless, this man is currently experiencing an absolutely unimaginable hell, and you would really hope somebody close to him would have hurled themselves between him and any microphones or cameras. But if they haven't done that, should media be broadcasting him?
My own feeling is no. That the man is entitled to what must be a moment of deep grief. He's lost his son, and he should be allowed some privacy, and not being able to put your head out of a window without half a dozen microphones being shoved into your face is no way in which to be able to confront this kind of situation. I think there are very broad issues here that have to be addressed, not just in the United States, about the access that journalists have to such people at such moments and about hounding by the press in general.
Tom, what did you think? I mean, at one level, his father did have things he wished to say. He wanted to apologize. Yep. He did say he wanted to apologize. He did say he was as bewildered and shocked as everybody else in the United States. He's since gone on to clarify his views by saying it's up to God to punish gay people, not his son, which is possibly a thought he might have kept to himself. But what do you think? Is it irresponsible of the media to put this man on the air right now?
I think it's legitimate to phone, to knock on the door. If he wants to find a quote-unquote safe house somewhere away from the glare, that's his call as well. But if people say, do you want to tell us about your side of it, and he's willing to do that, he has no one to blame but himself. And that's the option he's taken at this stage.
Sure, but I think what happens goes a bit beyond that. Mm-hmm. I mean, he wanted to say something to the media, but once they got hold of him, they were not going to let him go.
Mm. And Tom, what have you made of that? There has been some strange difficulty among some media about acknowledging the nature of the target. The first reports in the New York Times would not acknowledge that Pulse was a gay bar. We've had at least one newspaper here, well, at least the Daily Mail, not covering the story on its front page at all. And a couple of broadcasters, Sky News here as well, having sort of difficulty acknowledging the specifically homophobic nature of the attack.
I find that kind of a throwback, really, and, you know, given the changes that we've all seen, from civil to marital status, same sex, et cetera, I think, you know, we're well down the road to just report everything as it is. I don't see the holding back on that front at all.
And just finally tonight, as we are running out of time, and I'll ask you both quickly, are we going to see anything different in the next few days, or is this going to be the standard argument which will die away in the same amount of time and then we'll go around again the next time this happens?
I think which of those two routes we take depends a great deal on Donald Trump. If he decides to play heavy on this, then this could become something of a campaign theme. If not, then the echoes might start to die away.
And Tom?
I think you bring up a good point, John. The equation is a little different this time, but the standard form is as horrendous and how sickening people are feeling right now, not only in the States, but elsewhere around the world. Eventually, the numbness is there. Other stories take the front, and it just becomes something that you remember that happened a month ago, happened 6 months ago, until the next thing happens, and then the emotional roller coaster gets kicked off again.
Tom Rivers and John Everard, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all for today's Midori House. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alice Tennant. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Carlotta Ribello continues with the Atlantic Shift next at 1900 hours. It's The Culture Show with Rob Bound, and I'll have more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200 London time. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time, as ever. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.